Hey, 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 and welcome to the next episode of An Ordinary King. On today's show, we've got another good friend of mine, Simon Green, who is a Australian DOP or cinematography or director of photography. He's shot countless commercials, a feature film now, and a ton of short films which look extraordinary. He's a gifted, talented young man. He's also, hands down, I reckon, one of the sweetest, nicest guys you will ever meet in your life. If you ever get the pleasure of talking to him or meeting him, he says not one bad thing about anybody. And he has just a genuine love of the industry and the craft and all facets of it. And I really enjoyed talking to him. And I would love to talk to him again. I look forward to diving deeper into the technical world of camera and film and how things are made and why shots are chosen. So listen up for more of those episodes. In the meantime, here is the first installment of that, Simon Green.
It's better for me to leave them off.
The headphones?
Yeah.
Yeah, some people choose to leave them off, some people choose to leave them on. Personally, I prefer to leave them off. Because it feels weird, doesn't it? I mean, I do, you know, doing voiceovers or whatever, you listen, you have to have them on.
Then you're interested in the quality of your voice.
That's
and
right.
Thinking about what you're saying.
Right now, I couldn't give a fuck about the quality of my voice.
Yeah.
I'm not interested.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this. So that's where we're at.
Yeah.
We're live.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good to know. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this. I've been pretty excited about having a bit of a chat with you about, God, just about the stuff that you do and your interests and how you got and why you got to where you are, like why you were interested in doing it and... Yeah, just the stuff that you find cool.
Yeah, well, I've got a really unusual background as a cinematographer or director of photography in that my background when I started was as an actor.
So, really?
Yes. Didn't you know that?
No, you've gone all bashful.
Yeah.
Kind of like bashful like I did when I told you about my photography skills and my exposure rates.
So yeah, I actually studied acting when I finished my schooling. And I went to a university in Melbourne called Rusden, which from Deakin University, which is a strong background of a lot of really great actors, a lot of comedy actors actually coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the audition and they said, and here to show you how to do an improvisation is Jason Geary, who's pretty successful actor around.
Sure.
Now, but then he was in just about to start second year. He'd finished first year. He did an example of an improvisation between two characters, and I just went, "Oh my God, that's amazing! I'm inspired," and I was so inspired that I must have done a successful enough audition, and so then I was able to study acting, and I quickly, which was amazing, an extraordinary experience, and it blew my mind. I actually did dance as well.
I love dance.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, I'd never done dance before in my life. All I'd done was the odd school play and contact sport.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because contact sport's kind of a dance in a way.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes, can be. Yeah, yeah. For sure.
It's crazy.
And expanded my idea of how you could tell stories.
Right, okay.
And I sort of quickly became a little bit frustrated as an actor in that I felt like I had more to contribute to the storytelling process than just my little part.
What do you think that frustration was? Like, how was that frustration manifested? Was it just, did you just like get a couple of gigs on set or on stage and then you just felt like there was more to the story you wanted to contribute, or
That's exactly what it was. Yeah. It was more that I felt like I contributed. There was more quality that we could imbue into the production, which would convey the story, add layers to it. So I fell into theatre directing.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, by the time I finished my course, I'd made a couple of plays that were asked to be part of festivals, and it had been quite successful, felt quite successful. But I was, I'd always been interested in filmmaking, always loved it.
Yep.
Loved the whole process of it. Loved the weekend ritual growing up of walking down to the video store to grab a VHS, spending hours at the video store trying to choose almost as exciting as watching the actual thing, loving the trailers, and coming back and and I always felt that I loved the idea that you've got a very particular frame that you're working within and that you're controlling that point of view.
Sure.
I felt the reason why I'd been a successful as a theatre director was because I understood the relationship between the audience and the actor.
Right.
And because I'd been an actor, as a theatre director, I'd been able to facilitate that contract. What I felt like I didn't understand in filmmaking was what the camera did specifically. Right. It wasn't really true. There was lots I didn't understand. But that was one that I felt, which is interesting, but I always loved photography. I'd done stills throughout my high school.
Yeah, you're an amazing photographer.
No, thanks.
You are. You've got a good eye.
And so what I felt like, I didn't feel I had a full understanding of how that worked.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was able to work at a studio cleaning toilets and painting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a cinematographer working there doing a test commercial for a beer. And it was C-stands poking everywhere. There was bits of wood which they'd angled into certain positions. They didn't have a proper smoker. They had one of these ones which are actually illegal now. It's these old pine cone ones where they should put pine cones in this sort of like tin can thing and they'd pump it, they'd light it and pump it.
Oh, right on. And, yeah, okay. Right on.
And everyone would cough and splutter. And,
but it would smell good.
But be in real danger of running out of oxygen. It was amazing. When you looked at the monitor and you looked at what was constructed and the beams of light created through the smoke, I was completely inspired about what you can do with lighting and framing. And I went, yes, there is a way of completely controlling what you want to do. And I want to learn how to do that, how you want to tell your story. Yeah. Yeah. The nuance in which you want to adopt.
Sure.
Yeah. So then I had a very conventional background as a cinematographer in that I went and worked in a rental house. It was with film cameras, largely 16 and 35 millimeter film, which I feel fortunate about, and just prepping them. I went there to learn to load. And then one day, the guy who was kindly letting me work in there said, mate, I won't be in today, but if people call about renting stuff, can you just answer the phone and sort of help them out? Oh, yeah, sure, no worries. And they go, oh, and I'll pay you. Oh, don't worry about that. but anyway, I ended up working there. And so I did that, and then I worked out on set as a clapper loader and then as a focus puller, and then when I started shooting, I was fortunate enough, sat around, twiddled my thumbs for a little bit, and then I was fortunate enough to fall in with the ABC. And
the ABC used to have, and I think it's dwindling a little bit as their facility and their money gets cut, but they used to have a very good sort of progress program where they would bring people in and teach them, kind of like what a lot of my old friends talk about they did with Crawfords.
Yes.
And Crawford's had a very similar system, or maybe the ABC was modelled off that Crawford's system. I'm not quite sure. If people don't know, Crawford's is an old production house channel kind of. They'd shot Cop Shop and
Homicide,
everything really. Yeah, and so a lot of my friends that sort of went through as that are directors or actors in those days went through that system of being fortunate enough to go through.
And I was fortunate enough to work with cinematographers who had been trained through that.
Yeah.
Exactly what you're talking about. And they've got a pretty that when I was working there freelance, and it was about 3 years that I worked there freelance, and it was because one of their in-house cinematographers got a posting in Russia, and so he went there for three years, and I got a lot of his gigs, which was amazing. And they did a lot more programs with these guys who they trained from scratch.
Yeah,
and it was amazing. These guys are incredibly skilled, and the programs were great. Like you're going from Australian Story to 7:30 Report to the arts programs. I had a whole string of arts programs then, to Gardening Australia, to little comedy things where they reunited people. The little comedy sketches in there, but then they had this amazing segment where they reunited people who hadn't seen each other for like 20 or 30 years, and it was called Can We Help? And
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. Pete Rosethorn was the presenter on that. A fantastic show, really bizarre, offbeat show, but you got to film some amazing things, and that was a really great way because each of those programs have a different house style.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And what they do is they send you out with a car, and you in that car was set up by each different full-time cinematographer.
Sure.
So you'd take their car, and they set their car up the way they chose to set it up. So they had a budget, and they chose what lights they wanted to use.
Yep.
And so I got a chance to work with how these incredibly skilled cinematographers, because they were all incredibly skilled, had set up their vehicles. I got to work with how they chose to set it up with their lights and where they were positioned. And that was a wonderful experience because I got to use different tools in different ways.
Was there still some sort of creative license that you tried to pursue using that person's vehicle and what tools and stuff they had, knowing how that cinematographer or DOP shot using those? Would you try to?
I can't begin to. It's funny. I find it really hard. Like I can technically match what other people do.
Sure.
But when it comes to the nuance of how you technically do that, it's sort of your own in a lot of ways.
For sure.
Because you're working on the best possible outcome. Because you're just trying to do your best all the time. Everyone's just trying to do their best. So your best is the way that you do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You can't. So often you'll be given, you know, like if you've come into a story halfway through, you've got a map. They'll show you images and they go, "Can you match that?" And you go, "Yeah, yeah, no problem." Yeah, I've got to make it my own. But you don't have that conversation. But that's the
for
only way.
For sure, because you're going, how the hell did they do that? Well, I think they did this and did this, and if I do that, that'll look exactly like that. And it's probably almost a completely different setup, but you're still getting the same result.
Mm.
It's funny that when I watch films and TV shows now, after working in the industry for a long time, I don't have quite the same appreciation that I did when I was a kid or a teenager growing up. It's a very different, I'm not saying it's worse appreciation, but it's a different appreciation because I have an understanding of the process of how things are shot. And now after we shot our film, having a different appreciation of the back end of things.
Oh, yeah.
Is that something that do you have an issue watching stuff and being able to let go and just watch it for what it is, or
if I find it if I'm engaged by the story, I forget about all the technical stuff. I'm just in the story.
Amazing!
And I have to go back and watch it again to be able to watch it in a technical aspect. The stuff where if I think it's cheesy, or if I'm bored, that's when I start thinking about it technically. and or if I think it's unsuccessful, technically, I'll look at it.
How do you mean unsuccessful?
Oh, like it's in a couple of ways, on a very simple level, if it's exposed incorrectly, or I think the framing is bad, or the camera work's poor. But then, if you see it again, like you'll see it with certain action directors or something like that, when they're trying to do a scene that's about intimacy, and they will adopt what I think is the incorrect or the inappropriate cinematic language to tell that intimate story.
Sure.
And they might use a long lens and do tracking or something like that. When really what it requires is a bit of quietness and
just a bit of stillness.
A bit of stillness.
Yeah, a bit of patience.
Yeah. And that's when I'll come out of it and I'll go and I'll think about why it's not working and how we can make it better.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of about cinematography is about getting. It's about not being distracting, I think. About drawing people's attention to what you want them to be thinking about in these moments.
Sure.
So a lot of our discussions, for instance, when we're making our films, it's about what's this scene about? It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And it's about what's happening in the scene? Who's moving forward? What's happening to the characters? How do we talk about that visually? And using light and framing.
Light's amazing. Mm. I'm a big fan of light and shade. I love it. I'm a big fan of contrast.
Mm.
I had a question all lined up in my head and it's just evaporated like a drop of water in the Sahara at the moment. It's completely bloody gone. How's your coffee going?
Oh, it's good. It's good.
Thank you for the tea.
A pleasure.
What do you think, so with where technology is at the moment and where it's going, what do you think some of the drawbacks are of the gear that's coming out and the pros as well, but what do you think the challenges are? And
yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful, of course. I find it wonderful. I'm excited by technology. I love what it allows you to do in terms of being able to move more lean and quicker,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of what we're doing is about capturing truth, often, well, particularly in drama, you're about capturing truth between what performers, what actors can do.
Yeah.
And so being in a way where you're not putting restrictions on them, I think can be more helpful for them. And I think that a lot of that's what technology can do, which is fantastic. Where you've got to be really careful you've just got to do your due diligence and test the bloody things properly before you use them.
Sure.
So that you know where they're going to fall over, because with new technology, often they fall over in unexpected ways.
Sure, right.
And whether it's a reproduction of a certain colour, which happened with a lot of the red cameras early on, where they would go purple with certain colours and that kind of thing.
Well, they didn't quite have the colour science right for the.
Well, it's not that it's right. I mean, I suppose it's not right, but it's also it just falls over in certain areas, and as long as you're aware of it, you're not going to reproduce it on set.
Yeah,
and so you can walk around it. Mostly. And it's the same like with some of these gimbals. There can be a moiré, and if you've got to be aware of that. And, just things like that,
Because people get very excited about new technology and I mean, for me, when I always look at cameras, people are always talking about one – stills cameras, how many megapixels can it produce?
Yeah.
And then the other one when it comes to film cameras is what's its K, you know, and it's all it's always about that. But for me, it's the ability to capture the story and what's the story. That's for me with a film or with an image, it's what's it saying. So
And you know, like people talk about there's something really nice about the speed in which you're forced to work when you work with film.
Sure.
It's where you're forced to slow down and you're forced to rehearse it, because as soon as you turn over, you can hear the money going through the magazine. And that in itself brings a nice process.
And that's
what a lot of people, I think, missed when digital became more cost-effective to use. But then again, there's something cost-effective about rehearsing things and having a nice process with it. So there's yin and yang in everything.
There is, isn't there?
Yeah.
You just got to find your spot within that little balance, don't you, I guess.
Mm.
What are you excited about at the moment on TV and on film?
I think because there's so many different platforms in which people view things, it's really interesting, because if you're seeing things on a different platform, it means that you can tell things in a different way. So, like things that I've seen recently, like on providers like Netflix, is that you've got stories. That could be written more better. they could have had a bit more drafts,
time
on the drafts. But the exciting thing I think about that is that they're not interested in these providers are not necessarily interested in films that are going to keep bums on seats for a couple of weeks. It's to keep subscriptions going and things like that, and so it's a different kind of model to something that's being released in a cinema.
Yeah,
which I think is interesting, because it allows you different ways of telling a story, and that's what's really cool.
It's interesting
with series work, you know.
Yeah,
Yeah, different ways of telling a story, because people's experiences in life are so varied. And at one moment you might be in a phase where you're about, you know, trying to win work or sales or whatever you do for your work. You know, you're trying to be successful in that area, and then suddenly you're trying to be successful with trying to connect with your dog or your, you know.
Sure.
Or you're trying to find quietness. And yeah. I think that's what's great about stories, is that they can cross over those sorts of moments in your life and
sure.
talk about them all being worthwhile.
Well, significant in those moments. There's a significance in each individual moment that you've, and within those stories, that maybe outside of the story is not as significant as you may think.
Mm.
Like maybe connecting with the dog at that point was incredibly significant for some reason to you or to, you know, the dog, but maybe not as significant later on.
Mm.
You know, things the
validating emotions.
Yeah, they change, and there's a it's like I don't know how to quite to describe it, but it's like I think it's pointless getting into it, actually. It's like memory being blurred and distrust. It's like if you have a memory of something, what you remember is not usually actually what happened. So, and you try to remember something that you look at the memory that the incident that happened, and you have like, and you highlight an area of that memory that maybe wasn't so significant back then, but it is more so now, or I don't know. I think I need to think about that to articulate that a bit better.
what I think is important is for people's emotions to be validated and for people's stories to be validated so that they feel like they're valued.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that's what's beautiful. We all sit down and we watch a film and we watch these characters going through different struggles, is that we can identify with that, and therefore in a way we feel validated in our own lives and in our own struggles.
Yeah.
And that's bloody awesome. Yeah.
It's a good thing.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. It's I often think about these I often wonder if there's just a little bit too much content out at the moment for that. A lot of stuff seems a bit same.
Mm.
Although I am grateful for, because like the online platforms like Netflix and Stan and Hulu, they're opening up a lot of opportunities for people to release their stuff and people for things to be, for their work to be seen that didn't exist 5-10 years ago. But I do worry that because the focus is no longer on, say, the end result, but it's on the profitability, on the because, as you said before,
it's keeping subscriptions going.
Yeah, the framework's changed, right? I mean, quality is still quality, and like if you take networks like HBO, that really did pave the way for the slow form drama with shows like The Wire. I often wonder sometimes that the want for a different type of framework to keep the profits going, because at the end of the day, we're in a film and television, and we're in an industry that's a business. It's an art form that's a business, and it's all subjective. But I worry sometimes that the quality is just going to drop as people push for a faster turnaround, a shorter pre-time, shorter shoot time, shorter script working time. And I worry that sometimes the production value is going to drop, but maybe people's expectations will drop.
I don't think so. I think the cream rises to the top, that'll direct hope. I'm optimistic. I reckon if people are drawn to a particular thing and that's being watched more than others,
sure,
that'll hopefully create a model. I reckon.
Yeah.
That will be, you know. But in the meantime, sure, we're in a moment where there's a great upheaval.
Yeah.
And I think when that happens, people get screwed over in a lot of ways with hours on set and half-baked ideas and people trying to pump things out. But it'll find some equilibrium after that.
You think it'll swing back? It'll even out.
It'll even out, and then some other technology will leap forward, and we'll get screwed over again. But yeah, it's a cycle. There'll be good bits as well as bad bits in that.
What do you think of drones?
Drones can be fun. Yeah, they can be fun. Of course, they can be overused.
I think they're a bit overused at the moment. My opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are times where you can use them creatively, where you know, like you use them as a gimbal running through, you know, and running down a corridor or something.
Sure.
Like that.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And there's incredible uses for it, and so that, as someone who watches stuff, yeah, you can go, oh, I don't think they needed that drone shot, which was up high, took me out of the story. But as a cinematographer who now has another tool at my disposal, and I'm always, you know, my job is to be a tool for the director to realize their vision visually. But it's kind of, to do that, you've got to be inside their head if you're going to do it successfully, and you've got a great working relationship.
Sure.
And so you develop a friendship, you develop a trust, and that's a very special thing. And when you're part of that, you're a genuine, when it's working well, you're a genuine collaborator.
Yeah.
And they start to trust you. And so you can share your sensibilities with them. And then if you've got a, you know, people can use Steadicam too much. People can use shift tilt lenses too much. You know, all of our tools can be overused.
For sure.
And so... But having it there at our disposal at a moment that can really inject a bit of emotion into a scene because you've got this tool at your disposal is awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, some people just get a bit excited about some tools, don't they?
Yeah.
That's just fine.
Yeah.
It's totally fine. That's what they want to. I think that's fine. Mm. I'm also particularly interested in your background in documentary. You've done some pretty successful documentary stuff, and
yeah,
how do you find that differs shooting a documentary versus a drama or a film? How do you find that balance, and how do you find that challenge?
I love working on docos. They're not the thing that I run to automatically, though.
Sure.
Just because it can feel, ironically, a bit like lying to me sometimes.
What do you mean?
Well, sometimes you've got to make a choice in a documentary, just like you've got to make a choice in a drama.
Yep.
You've got to make a choice about what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
And the director and the producers have to make that call.
Yep.
About what that story is. And if you're filming it, and in the process of filming it, as a cinematographer, you see other stories that emerge there that you feel are just as important or overwhelmingly
significant.
You've got to let that go if they don't see it that way, because your funding's been structured around the story being about such and such.
Sure.
And so you've got to let that go. And I've encountered that whilst working on documentaries, where I've seen another story be there, but it just hasn't been something that we've been able to explore.
Sure.
And I found that challenging.
Yeah. Is that so? Do you think that you feel like that's lying because you're not telling what do you think the appropriate story is, or do you think that's just not telling the appropriate story?
Well, sometimes another component of the story is... I'll give you a specific example.
All right. Okay.
So I did a documentary about dolphin hunting in the Solomon Islands, which was an amazing experience.
It's a good doco too.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So, and that was an amazing experience. Certainly one of the most remote places I filmed, let alone been to.
Yep.
But there were characters in that we who are real people. They're not just characters; they're real people, and they were seen as people who were compassionate in the story.
Sure.
But then you hear other things about them. That were contradictory to who they are in the story.
To their character. Sure.
And you can't explore that because it's not what the story is about. And even as powerful as that might be, it's certainly something that you can't explore because the wheels have already been set in motion.
Mm. It's interesting. I love documentaries, and so I love what I think about documentaries or when someone's like you. It's not talking about like the BBC World stuff, okay? Because that's, I think, talking purely about a human element documentary, because I think humans are very contradictory, hypocritical creatures. But so remove BBC World, that incredible series that's been running for, God, It's amazing. Mm. But you watch, like, I love, like, the human documentaries that people like Ross Kemp does, not the basketball player.
Yes.
Ross Kemp does, Louis Theroux.
Yes.
The human documentaries that they do. Mm. And I love the fact that they explore those hypocritical elements and those contra, because they don't have an idea of, like, let's go on and this is the story we're telling. They go on with, like, look, here's the facts. This war-torn area, like, we believe it's through oil or drug trade or sex trafficking, and then you get into it and you're like, it's so much more complex than what you think. And the one person you think is Mother Teresa is part of the problem.
Mm. Yeah, they've got a context for their documentaries, which is really great. And because it's driven by what they think, that they can see the complexities in it. And it's almost a different model. It's almost a specific genre within documentary making, isn't it?
Do you think some documentary making films go for... I'll do my best to try to explain this, but to go for social right views and go for text because that person's doing the right thing, so to show them a bad way versus going for the truth?
It's hard. Like for instance, the dolphin hunting documentary was about... The journalist had to sell the idea. It was done by a program for Al Jazeera called 101 East. A fantastic journalist called Drew Ambrose, and you know, he lives and breathes this stuff, and he comes up with these ideas, and it has to have the conflict in it, and he sells that to the network, and they go, yep, it's a 101 East story. And so the conflict story there was about a non-for-profit paying a village not to hunt dolphins, and which is of course really bad community development, and a misunderstanding of how money works within the Solomon Islands, within village culture.
Sure.
And so, so they stopped hunting for a little bit, and then not everyone received the money, and everyone became grumpy, and then they resumed hunting again, and so now everyone's upset, and so that was the story. And so I didn't have room to look at individuals within the context of that story. And I understand that. But as a filmmaker, as a cinematographer who's coming in to realise that story, whilst it's a pleasure to be able to be a part of that, it's hard to see these other stories that emerge that you
believe
are, and you see, and you know that they can never have screen time because... that's what the story is for that particular doco.
For what that format was optioned for example.
And, you know, and people say, like, when you're doing a drama or a commercial or whatever you're doing, that often behind the scenes is more interesting than what you're actually filming.
Sometimes it's funnier. Some shows you work on, you're like, oh my God. like the people, the camera should be pointed the other way.
Yeah.
Or down the street at the next door neighbor's house.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shot a show recently, and you know what it's like turning up to someone's house that's been rented.
Mm.
So you're renting this house to shoot at. And we're shooting at this house, and the two people that I'm going to say owned, I'm not 100% sure whether they owned it or not, but they out the front with a handycam, like the old Sony with the disc.
Oh, love it.
Handycam shooting the crew.
That's great.
Oh, mate. I was like, wow, that's incredible. Sitting there like this and hiding behind the gate as well, like pretending not to be like, and they were being all sus about it, like hiding the camera and like, you know, are we allowed to be doing this and shooting it with a little handy cam thing? It was fucking brilliant. Well, it was great.
I guess for me is I accept that that's the difficulty of our art form in that it's our duty to try and make what's on screen more interesting than what
is in real life.
Real life. And so that for me is the difficulty of the art form. And when you're making a drama, that that context is set out for you, and I'm happy with that. I love that challenge.
Yep.
But when it comes to shooting documentary, it's just a lot more complex. And so whilst I really like it, I really feel my calling is towards drama, you know, in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the context is there. I'm more happy with that.
Do you think it's also a control thing?
Yeah. It's about control, and it's about, it's about me feeling as though what's being asked of me is more complete.
Sure.
About what I can offer. Yeah. The production is more complete.
Okay.
It's asking everything from me.
Yeah.
I want to give. I want to give everything I can when I get into a project. And if I'm being asked in the context of a drama, because we're trying to realise the journey of these characters, I feel as though I can give everything I've got. Whilst on a doco, it's just it's a different kind of context. Yeah.
How do you feel at the moment about the Australian film and television industry? How do you think? What do you think it's positioned in globally as well as domestically, in terms of the type of content that's coming out?
I think we consistently shoot above our weight in terms of what we're delivering, the quality and the stories that come out. I think there's a journey in terms of the way the funding structure is happening at the moment, and government policies need to catch up with how technology has changed the way
we view stuff
and about quotas on that they need to be reviewed and made more up to date. And I think that's the challenge at the moment.
But do you think that's affecting what people are seeing, like what the audience is seeing?
It's affecting, yeah, absolutely. And it's affecting what films are getting up and being made at the moment. So there's room for more great Australian stuff to be put out there.
Yeah.
If those funding structures are there, they're certainly there in the woodwork. They just need to come out.
Do you think that funding structure, I mean, I know this is maybe not what you specifically, where your field sits, but do you think those funding structures are what's important in re-energising or keeping an industry sustained and going? Or do you think it's the business model and it's bringing the investors here? Do you think it's government money, or do you think it's going to be private money?
Both. It has to be both.
Okay.
Yeah, it has to be both, because different funding structures bring different kinds of stories. And so you want to be able to have both. So you've got a variety of cash monies and a variety of different stories lean towards different funding structures.
Sure.
Different styles of story, yep. Different styles of story. And we want to have a wide variety. And
we do. Yeah. We do want a wide variety. We want a wide variety of content that's out there and available for different types of people that want different types of things.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just, for me personally, there just isn't a lot of Australian content that I find amazing. Wentworth's incredible, groundbreaking series that's doing really well around the world. I think Stan's doing a really good job in terms of an online network that's provider that's doing they're giving a lot to the industry. They're trying to beef it up.
Mm.
Yeah, Netflix is cutting the Australian content, the amount that's shot here, like Australian, cutting the amount that they're putting on there.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, I know, and at the moment, like,
and the ABC is like reduced funding, reduced facilities, and more outsourced. And
And Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries is amazing, but it great period stuff. But yeah, like the problem with the Netflix model is that you've got people. You've got to put in your you've got to make it relevant to a wider, because we're so small, and this will be made to a wider Netflix audience.
That's right, yeah.
And so you've got to have your American characters in there and all that kind of stuff, which can be limiting.
Yeah, it's a tough choice to make.
Mm.
It's a tough choice to make, and one that we're close to, as you know.
Mm.
I don't know, what else is going on for you?
Well, my I guess my structure is it's about building. So there's a certain director who, there's quite a few directors who, you know, you sort of hang around,
yeah,
and they're developing work, and you're hoping that you're in the forefront of their thinking.
Sure.
That's sort of how I do it. and so there's some amazing stuff that's in development that you're hoping will be, you know, coming out soon, that
sure
will be finished, that I'll be getting an opportunity to work on soon. And so you do that, and in the meantime you keep on banging away doing commercials, which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
So
you do a fair bit of commercial work, don't you?
Mm, that's my bread and butter.
Along with most people, I think, in Australia.
Mm, mm. Commercials are great in that it's like exercising your muscle. And
sure.
You're getting paid to exercise your muscle.
Yeah.
And you get to play with toys, and and you have to communicate stuff down to often to an nth degree to yep. realize stuff, because you're making it for a gallery of people.
Yep.
And that's I find that to be a pleasure. I really enjoy that. I love trying to work in that realm, and still, that's the third time I've hit the microphone.
Not gonna matter.
I love being trying to not dilute what you're doing, to keep having a visual impact in what you're doing.
Sure.
But being able to satisfy the technical requirements of people who work in advertising crews, you know, that their pack shot, that their car has certain attributes that are being portrayed to the viewer, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And I love that. I love that.
Yeah. I love how much time gets spent on commercials per second versus anything else.
Mm.
How much money? I think there's nothing else out there that compares regarding time versus dollars spent as a commercial. I think it's amazing. And you're right. You totally get time to exercise and practice on different tools and bring in different technologies and see what will work and.
Mm.
I that's a process I love. I love shooting and working on commercials as well. I haven't done a commercial as an actor in a while. I feel like for various reasons, but it's fun to be on, fun to work on. Just the amount of time, although the hours are long.
Mm.
Hours are often much much longer on commercials than anything else, I find.
Mm. But they're shorter, aren't they? You're not working over months. You're working over days or day.
or a couple of weeks with some of the big ones, like the tourism ones. The Tourism Victoria did last year or year before.
Mm.
It was I think 2 weeks.
Mm.
Mm. Which is a good show, but long days, but fun. I do enjoy them. And some of the commercials coming out and some of the commercial work coming out in Australia is pretty good.
Mm.
I think some of it's pretty funny, good. Yeah. And it's hard though, isn't it? It's hard telling a story.
In 30 seconds. Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's not really 30 seconds. It's less with your banner up there.
Your header and your footer.
It's less. And there's things about storytelling in commercial work, which I think true about having stories that aren't negative and positive and not manipulative. And I love it when you look at the history of television commercials, just like you do of the history of films, about how sexual politics changes and about how people relate to each other as changes. You see it in early on in 1950s, where you might see the woman being denigrated in the story structure, and then as we move forward, it became popular for the man to be denigrated in a relationship, the silly husband kind of story.
Yep.
And now hopefully we're finding it again. And now you also, we're at a time, and I feel like it's only really happened recently, we're able to see different cultures on screen, which is amazing given the diversity of our country, that only recently we're only, you know, able to see someone from an Asian or Indian, or let alone Aboriginal background. Like, it's just...
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's weird that it's only been recent. It's a shame. I think it's a good thing. I don't like focusing and saying, oh, it's a shame it's taken this long. I think it's great that it's here now and it's coming to the forefront and it's becoming part of people's focuses. I think it's more of a positive way of saying it rather than saying how shit it is that it didn't happen 10 years ago, because we're living today.
Yeah.
You know, so I enjoy it. We actually went and saw a really good, very fortunate enough, went and saw a very good film, Emma and I, about 2 weeks ago. We were invited to the premiere of Top End Wedding.
Oh, right. Yeah, great.
Amazing.
Great.
Hilarious.
Great.
Hilarious film. Yeah, I fully recommend people to go and see it. We loved it.
Mm. Well, Wayne Blair is such an amazing director. You know, Sapphires is such a... it's a classic Australian film, and
I haven't seen it.
Ah,
I'm so sorry.
do yourself a favor. Go see it. It's amazing. It's
very funny too, isn't it? Supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Very funny. Such extraordinary casting too. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Top End Wedding was great. It was a really good film. Shot beautifully. Great script. Great story.
Mm.
Yeah. Great. Great film. I recommend going to see it. It's just a good story.
Mm.
What I liked was good humor, good script.
It's on my list.
Yeah. Have you seen Roma yet?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
What do you think?
Amazing. It was amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Being able to tell, and that's, I think, being able to tell that story. That's a really good example of, where a provider like Netflix has really facilitated a certain kind of story being able to be told. Like that story, like the maid and her relationship with the family, that I don't think it could have been made if streaming platform didn't exist.
Appreciated?
Well, I think it'd be pretty hard for it to be, because they spent a long time making that film with a pretty decent budget. And if you were making it just for a cinema,
yep,
in our current climate, I'm not so confident that the funding for that would get up to be made.
Right.
Yeah,
because the revenue stream wouldn't be there.
Yeah, the revenue stream wouldn't be there because people are more prepared to watch, you know, that kind of a story in over that time period.
I would have loved to have seen it at a cinema.
Yes, Acme screened it for a bit, and I would have loved to have seen it there too. Yeah,
I feel like it's a cinematic story.
Mm.
I agree with you. Like, I remember reading an interview that he did, and he said that he wanted it released on a streaming platform so that more people could watch it. That's what he wanted. He didn't want it to be limited to just a cinema release so that just a few people saw it. He wanted a big reach with it. But watching it, I don't know, some of the scenes, the way that they were composed, I felt like you needed a bigger screen.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to take in what was going on. Some of those long shots that were held and the drifts and stuff. I really felt like it needed a bigger screen than, well, I mean, we watch everything, unfortunately, on a small screen, but just to have it on a big screen with good sound, I think would have been amazing.
Absolutely.
Would have helped me appreciate it a lot more than what I did. The first time I watched it, I didn't appreciate it.
Well, I think that brings me to another, which I think is really interesting. When you're making a theatre piece,
yep,
you have the opportunity to change your performance. You get a sense of what the audience is feeling.
Sure.
And you can, the actors can modify what they're doing and become more quiet or more loud, or they can become more vigorous or slower,
yeah, for sure,
to engage more with the audience. Of course, you don't have that opportunity when you're working
On film.
On film. You can just make the best possible thing you think you can. Mm-hmm. And what, as an audience, when you go see something, you've sort of got a responsibility to yourself and to the work that you're going to go and see, that it's not a responsibility, but it's just something that you should probably acknowledge, is that if you've had a bit of an agitated day and you're seeing something that's and you've been working really hard and you're going to see something that's sort of slower and more contemplative, it's not really going to connect. You're probably going to, if you're like me, you might fall asleep, something like that.
Yeah.
You need to be rested. You need to...
Ready for it. Psychologically, I think you're right. Yeah.
And also where you're watching it as well. Like, it changes, the experience changes before when you're watching it on your phone as opposed to your computer, as opposed to TV, as opposed to screen. And they're different experiences as well. And I think that's something that can be enjoyed as someone who watches stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Because it, you know, comedy might play differently on something that's smaller, you know. Certainly when you're filming. I was about to talk about comedy for a sec, because I've filmed comedy as well. But I've had the pleasure of doing some great comedy stuff. Ironically, when you do comedy, it's the most constricted you are as a technician to any of the other art forms, I reckon, or genres of storytelling, because the pressure on you to be even less distracting is really important, because people need to get the joke. And so classic rules in terms of filmmaking are really important, like not crossing the line, you know.
Because people can't be pulled out of it.
Can't be pulled out of the story. And so your idea of, you know, like close-up, mid-shot coverage is really important in terms of that sort of pacing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And often I've worked with on particular programs, and directors go, mate, we're working with comedians here. They're not actors. Make sure we do the close-up first, because they get bored.
Yeah, well, I remember talking to a director recently who directs a lot of comedy stuff in Melbourne, and he said that stand-ups or a comedian's energy fuse is very short, and they burn very bright very early, and then it just sort of peters into just a puddle of wax on the floor, and that's your candle left, and you're just like left... Fuck.
Yeah, yeah, they're not marathon runners.
They're sprinters.
Sprinters.
Yeah, a couple of jokes and then boom, they're out. God. Mm. What have you worked on that's been comedy?
I've done a little bit on the McAuliffe.
That's McAuliffe, right, you did too, yeah.
But and some of my other favourite stuff has been these independent comedy guys, Mitch McTaggart. And a fantastic program called Head Swapsies, which was about...
What was that? Because you started doing that last year, weren't you?
I think it was last year, yeah.
Or a year before? I think it was last year.
And it's about two scientists who swap heads and then have to navigate each other's bodies. And it's classic slapstick stuff. And it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, really, really great. And an opportunity to tell some really busted stories and the directors really wanted really, you know, it to look nice as well.
Sure.
So we thought about that a lot beforehand.
Right.
So it was a real pleasure. The first location was amazing. Like, we had to film in Kensington, in this old sewing factory, I think it was, but it's been abandoned for years.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Underneath it, they have like artist studios and stuff like that.
Right on.
But up the top, and they wanted to shoot at the top, and so we had to haul all of our stuff up there, all of our props and things like that. And it was a really narrow sort of staircase.
Yeah.
And there wasn't like you know, it was comedy. It was a reduced budget thing. It was shown on the ABC, but it was I couldn't have a gaffer. I just had sort of skilled people helping me out. I had a camera assistant, which was great. But we what I did was, and I wanted it to look like night, and we're shooting day for night.
Yeah.
And so I had the technical difficulty of doing that. And I just remember taking these old, well, it's old Blondies, which are 2,000 watt open face tungsten lamps. And I got 10 of them. 10 of them. So it's quite a lot of light. And I keyed with those through a 6x12 sailcloth, and made sure that we balanced to that.
What do you mean by light? Keyed through?
That was my key light.
So, oh, right. Okay, so yeah. Your main light?
Yeah, yep. My main light.
Right.
And which is warm.
20 lights.
Ten lights. 10 of those. Yeah, 2,000 watt lights. And so, but that's a lot of strain on your electricity system.
It's a lot of juice, yeah.
So we're running cables all from backs and tops on different circuits, which we managed to do. And I had other lights in there as well, so it was more than that. But
Jesus Christ!
But we balanced to those lights, and in the air, and my idea was that that's going to be brighter.
Yep.
But and then the ambience around it is daylight.
Sure.
I balanced to those tungsten lights, so that's a warmer light, and so that means the daylight that swims around is blue.
Or cooler.
Yeah, cooler. So, which is sort of how you see. It's a classic way of doing night, you know.
But, sure.
But because when you see at night, what actually happens to you at night is that colour is the first things to go in your receptors.
Right.
But often your brain doesn't realise that and still interpreting colour.
So you think you're seeing colour.
Colours. It's your memory of colour that you're seeing, but often that's a diluted version. And so blue is a really good way of sort of telling that story. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. But anyway, it was a lot of hauling up stuff. But I was really happy with the look of that.
Yeah, good.
Of being able to film in this sort of like big dirty warehouse with looking day for night, you know, and the opportunity to do it during the day and not do it during the night where everyone gets really, really tired.
yeah, night shoots are tough. I don't think it's good for people to be shooting through the night. I don't know, working some of those hours that people do, like night shift workers, I don't think it's
very... Sometimes we have to, but
yeah,
that's okay. And that's fun. It's fun having to do stuff that you have to do sometimes for short periods.
Yeah, it is.
To push yourself, you know.
I like it.
Mm. I know you like pushing yourself. I've seen you work before. You love pushing yourself.
Yeah. I think it's important. Yeah. Like, I think I'm struggling to find any other way to work other than just like, what, you know. Because I'm big about learning. I'm big about, like, you know, because I don't believe everyone knows everything, and there's always something you can learn off someone else, and doesn't matter how big or small it is, and because there's other people that you work with as well, that they're there for a reason, because they, you know, and you just want to work to make sure that you're respecting the fact that these people have worked to be where they are, and you just don't want to be a lazy piece of shit on set that sits there eating biscuits and drinking tea all day long. You want to, like, contribute.
You want to give of yourself, don't you? It's like, yeah, like what we were talking about earlier. You want to be in a way in which you can give as much as you can.
Yeah. Like, yeah. If I get home and I'm absolutely shagged, it's like that. I'm okay with that as long as I've left it. As long as I've left it on set, and as long as I've contributed on set, you know, because I know that I can wake up the next day and I'm all right. I'm good. I can. 6 hours sleep and smash into it, get another day, and I know that I can bring the energy if you need it. But I just don't believe in not turning up and not contributing and not giving it your all.
Yeah,
you know, we're very, very it's a hard industry, but I think it's a fortunate industry. It affords travel. How many places have you been around the world now that you wouldn't have been able to go to?
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And how many stories do, like, and that's another reason why I do what I do, is because I love stories.
Mm.
You know, and I think one of the main things listening to you speak as well, that seems to be, to me, what I get out of this, is that that's your main drive, is just how is telling and contributing and telling a story. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think that's why you're maybe drawn to it as well, is that just that need to tell a story in life. Do you think that's right?
Absolutely. Stories as I said earlier, it's about validating people's experiences, making people feel as though they're worthwhile, and it means that we're able to share. It's and then grow. It's fundamental as far as I can see.
Yeah. Is there stuff that you look back on when you're growing up as a kid that you, or even now, just to say that you feel like really influenced you into being a storyteller and the path that you're in now?
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about this today, actually. You know that thing on Facebook where they go list 10 films, no explanation.
Have you not on Facebook?
Facebook's horrible, but it's so don't go on it. But there's this thing that but I stay on it because for work.
Sure.
And to be honest, like that Solomon Islands doco, I wouldn't have got if I wasn't on Facebook, because of just the way that communication happened, and I was able to speak to Drew when he was overseas somewhere. Mm-hmm. But there's this thing that goes around where you nominate someone and you've got to list 10 films that were an influence on you, no explanation, but just have put up an image of it. And a director who I've worked with a bit before, who's a fantastic director, Gabrielle Bullard, she nominated me, and it was a few months ago now, and I haven't been able to do anything, and I felt so guilty. But then I've realised that the reason why I haven't is because trying to work out what those 10 films are is so bloody hard. But the one that influenced me in so much as a kid is very easy for me to say, and that's E.T.
I was going to guess E.T.
Yeah, really?
I was going to guess E.T. That's what I had in my head.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. Yeah, I just think that's an extraordinary film. And the family politics in that film that is not overstated, that comes out as that's bubbling away underneath Elliot's character, and the relationship between his mom and his brother and sister, just for me, is the duck's nuts in terms of and the way it was shot as well, with its us cinematographers call it negative fill, but the light and darkness is I find it completely compelling, and so many dimensions come out in that simple story, but it tells that story so broadly about, the divorce in the family and all of that kind of stuff, and the yearning for his friendship with to feel connected, which happens with an alien. it's just beautiful. Like there's so many unconscious yearnings in that story.
It's a beautiful story. It's a good film.
Mm.
I haven't seen it in so long.
It holds up in so many places still.
Right.
Because I watch it irregularly.
What's that mean?
Like I watch it again and again.
How many times do you watch it?
Oh, how many times have I seen E.T.? I don't know, about 50 or something. Maybe more. So, yeah. But it holds up surprisingly well, particularly the family drama stuff.
Sure, sure.
That some of the technology stuff in terms of E.T. isn't so
puppetry,
crash-like.
Wasn't it?
A lot of puppetry stuff, which often holds up really well in terms of doesn't
I
date.
I think I find that, I look at the Star Wars films and a lot of the puppetry stuff versus the CGI stuff definitely holds up. Lord of the Rings is a very good example of that as well.
Yeah.
But, the Star, I agree, the puppetry stuff's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So
I have to watch it again.
Yeah. Oh no, it's just great. It's great. My favorite scene in E.T. is when there's an argument around the family table.
Yeah.
About washing up. About whose turn it is to wash up. And at the same time they're talking about how he'd seen this mysterious alien creature, and the mum's just saying, Don't go out and see it again. But what materializes in it is like a power play over a family dinner meal. And I just think, and the power play happens because no one wants to wash up and help the mum. But then what happens is that there's a complete shift in that. In that there's where they've realized they've upset their mum. The mum and how sad they feel about doing that. The kids do. And about how lonely that makes them feel. And I just think it's an amazing scene. Yeah. And then and then visually it finishes beautifully because he turns on the hot water taps and steam rises and he's looking out thinking about this alien. And so the steam's rising on his face. It's beautiful. Beautiful scene.
It's a well-told story. I haven't read the book. I want to read the book.
Oh, all right.
Have you read it?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to. I think it's a book, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it's a book.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll look that up.
Yeah. I guess there's the only one other thing I wanted to talk about and acknowledge is that that filmmaking is such a collaborative art form, and so when you're choosing, because often I get to choose what kind of who my crew are,
sure,
what my grip, who my grip is, who my gaffer is, who my camera assistant is, who my second camera assistant is. Sometimes, often I'll take that suggestion from the first camera assistant, but choosing that I found it to be not only is it their skill level, but it's their personality, which is so important, and about how and different people bring different things, and they're more suited, I think, to different forms of storytelling. Not only what can they bring technically, sure, but also their personality in how they contribute,
yep,
to a story. And that's a pleasure as well. It's hard work trying to choose that, because if you get it right, it's fantastic. So it's worth spending time thinking about that.
Sure.
And but I really enjoy that as well. Because I like working with people.
I think that's another reason why the industry is so amazing, is you get to work with such a variety of people, there's such a variety of personalities and people that work in the industry in different in different fields. Mm. Grip, gaff, production, accountings, directors, actors, and they all have such different stories. And
those beautiful art department people. Love those art department people.
How hard do they work?
Mm. It's so hard.
Art department's ridiculous.
So hard.
Yeah.
So hard.
There's two jobs that I think I would struggle in, is art and gaff.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Gaffing, they're just non-stop all day.
You'd be fine as a gaff. You'd be fine. You'd be fine. It's art department. Yeah.
Art department's hard.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. Like getting those personalities
right,
and is part of the joy.
I did want to ask that, I'm so sorry that I've had such a mental fog today. One of the main questions I wanted to talk about was where you see yourself as a DOP in the production process, like in terms of like getting a project up, right? So you write your script, you start attaching people to it, you shoot it, you edit it, and then the audience views it. Mm. What's your position? Where do you see the best use of a DOP from your perspective, Simon? Where do you see that? Where do you see this is where I start facilitating?
I think if you can have early conversations with your DOP. I think that's...
What's early?
Early is after your... it looks like it's happening.
Right, yeah, because you want a job.
Yeah, it looks like it's happening. And start, and it sometimes even, there's particular directors who I'm working with at the moment, and I say, you call me when you're writing, I don't mind.
If you want
to run something past me. But certainly when it looks like it's happening, because the way we film something can so determine, like when we did our film.
Yeah.
We've got one jib shot in it.
Unfortunately.
And I think it's that jib was well placed.
I agree.
And the nature of our film was that there wasn't a lot of room because of the time and the pace that we're moving at. But that discussion about where I think we used it in the right spot.
Yep, I agree.
But the way we film things is, so having early discussions about how we do that is really important, because you can save a lot of money, and you can work out what are the bits where you need that extra bit of equipment to break that story and to make it feel bigger than what it is, or to give it the depth that you want it to have.
Sure. Yeah. So say you've got a $10,000 budget, how can we, like, with that 10 grand, how can we turn it into something that looks like it's $1 million?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it doesn't look budget and rushed.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is the part of the story where you need that bit of expensive equipment?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Mm. Mm.
So coming on early, as early as possible.
Mm. Mm.
Hey. And welcome to the next episode of Ordinary King.
Have less crew on today's and can spend more show, time filming.
We've got another good friend of mine. So then during that process, is it up to the DOP to determine DOP the crew that they work with, or is it a director of photography conversation, or a
it's a bit of both, but having an honest conversation about what kind of crew you need as a DOP gives people an indication.
He's a gifted, talented young man. He's also, hands down, I reckon, one of the sweetest, nicest guys you will ever meet in your life.
It's a really hard balance to try and work out.
Sure. Meeting him, he says not one bad thing about anybody. And he has just genuine love of the industry and the craft
And often all facets of it.
And I really enjoyed talking to him.
Person when you're rigging,
and I would love to talk to him again. I look forward to diving deeper into the technical world of camera
and how things are
made and why shots are chosen. So listen up for more of those episodes. In the meantime, here is the first installment of that. Simon Green.
And having that fought out, because no one wants to wait around on lighting. Everybody wants to go when they're on set. Everybody wants to go, and that's completely right, because it's about what's happening in the space at that time. And so it's my job to make sure that waiting around for lighting is minimum.
Mm. Do you think you'll ever go back to theatre and do something?
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I've had some really great experiences actually working with theatre directors who have done films.
Sure.
That's been a real fun thing about getting them to journey over from a proscenium arch or a theatre in the round to thinking about lenses and about
and how they tell their story within the frame again.
Yeah, and about what the difference between what a longer lens does to a wider lens, why we might track, why we might not track.
Sure. And what is that when you start getting into, like, your emotional, I know we touched on it earlier, but when you start getting into your emotional moments or your comedy moments and start people talking, like, so as an audience member, I'm watching a scene on TV and it's emotional, why am I being drawn into that? What is that lens done, that length of lens done with the lighting that's drawn that person into that scene, into that moment?
To me, a lot of your choices are about it's about people in space. And what that means is people in rooms or out in forests or what space are they in? and it's about how important is the space related to their struggle.
Sure. Okay. I think I know what you mean. Yep.
And how important is that struggle, or at that moment in the story, is it an internal struggle or a struggle about someone else, another person who's outside them?
Yep.
So for me, it's often about that. So do we, when I, because I can shoot, I can, you can make choices if you've got options available to you about how much the background goes out of focus.
Yep.
How much the people are enveloped in their space, like how much.
Oh, okay. So whether the space is occupying that person, like how much they're being swallowed by it, small, how big they feel in that.
Absolutely. That's a great one. How big or small they feel inside that. Little simple things about status are really important about how high your lens is.
Yeah.
About whether you're looking down on someone or up at someone, but also about how they are located in that space. And or do you not want to see them at that point in the space? Do you just want to see that it's a struggle? We want the background to fade away into nothingness.
Sure.
Or to just be out of focus, you know, because what's important is what's happening in their eyes at that moment. Or yeah.
Because it's incredible how much the frame that the audience is given pulls them in or out of the story. Because of what you're showing them. And that's what I think I love about film versus theatre. I mean, with theatre, you show people what they need to see with light. But with film, you're showing them, like, this is what you need to be looking at right now. And you can show them that with, like, as you said, like, depth of field type of light coming in, how much space they're in versus how much the littler, like the film Phone Booth, how difficult that would have been to have shot, you know. Or so I think, yeah, it's interesting. I always think that's like a technical thing that I don't know a lot about, and I know a lot of friends of mine that always ask questions about, like, why they've been drawn into something versus them not being drawn into something. And the types of technology or lens or whatever that person's used.
Well, when you go through a script as an actor, you're looking at each beat in a script. You're looking at the emotional beats that you're going through.
Depending on the stage, yeah, sure. Depending on, like, what stage of the script I'm looking at. Like,
yeah.
Normally I look at, if I'm looking at a script, I'm looking at, like, one, is the story any bloody good?
Yeah.
You know, if it's good, okay, then what's that character's position within that whole machinery? What's that cog? And how to facilitate that cog? So the beats, yeah.
The beats, and you're looking at each sentence and then you look at it down to the nuance of a word.
Yep.
And that's I really enjoy that bit when I'm able to get down to working that out.
Yep.
So I'm following you in that journey, and then I'm making compensations around that. So in that, I'm filming not only your close up, but I'm filming it, covering it in a wide or in a mid shot as well,
at the same time, multicam.
Yeah. Or not the same time. Often, you know, I prefer to do it single cam or two cam. To go to two cameras is my favourite often, because then you know you're allowing, you have to slow down. Because often the better frame to get when you're capturing a particular moment in a script is you're in front of someone else's camera if you're shooting it with lots of cameras, and then that's a bit more like Neighbours, you know, not that we don't like Neighbours, but it's just that you know, you're moving through it too fast and you're not thinking about every single moment, which is what I like.
Sure. Yeah,
every beat has a significance, and that that adds to the story, and that's why. Yeah.
Amazing. I don't know, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Nah, I think that's a lot.
Apart from your recent amazing article in the Australian Cinematography magazine. I think you're going to bashful again. It's just nice to see you get recognised, and it's nice to see you get written up, you know what I mean? It's nice to see you, the work that you've done and the hard work that you've been put in is getting is is getting noticed and recognized and celebrated a little bit. You know what I mean? You work hard and you do really well.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great. I'm really happy that I was able to mention, and there's people I'm sure we've forgotten in that article.
For sure,
But the people who, you know,
the team around
you. That really make it possible.
Yeah.
It's a real privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention? Or were you happy?
Yeah, we're pretty happy. Yeah.
Sick. We usually are. But I don't know. I just want to say thank you so much for jumping on the show and just talking about it. And the technical aspects and then also why you're drawn to the frame world. It's been a great chat, and yeah, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
No dramas.